Hey everyone, I just wanted to say really quick, I have a new podcast that you can listen to if you want to. It's called The Level Up Pod, together with Murph, who some of you may know from Game Nights or the Command Zone podcast. We're just talking about the video games we own, the consoles we love, and why we love collecting. You can check it out anywhere where podcasts are found. Follow us at LevelUpPod_ on Twitter. Thanks. Hello, and welcome to the Herald's Horn. On this episode, I am joined by my co-hosts to talk about the United States RC. The regional championship was just this last weekend. We chat a lot about that. Some different stuff happened. We talk about some of it. We don't talk about all of it. We talk about the future of regional championships in America. They're going to be run by Star City Games now. How do we feel about that? What's going on? How about those promos they showed off? WotC put up an AI position. Spoiler, it's for video games, but we're going to talk about it anyways. And of course, we have the Product Watch, the co-host notebook. We talk about Modern Horizons 3 for a good long while. It's a fun time. After the break, I talk to Sam from the Howling Salt Mine podcast about him, how the podcast started, his history with Magic, why they make the podcast, what he loves doing about it, his favorite stuff, all that, you know? It's another great episode. Without any further ado, let's get into it. Wait. Post-production Cal cutting in to say, email me, editorial@heraldshorde.com. I'd love to hear from you. We'd love to talk about whatever you have to say. Thank you. Hello. You are listening to episode number 12 of the Herald's Horn. What's up, everyone? Thank you for listening. It's great to be here on the 12th episode. I still can't believe I made it past 10. My name is Cal Jones, and today I am joined by the wonderful Emma. Welcome back. It's been a minute. Say hello, Emma.
Hello, Emma.
What's up, Emma? How are you? How are you doing?
Good. Today? I'm better. I don't have COVID, which is a plus, and I'm not jet lagged, which is also a plus. So yeah, I'm doing good.
Yep. After a month of being miserable, Emma has finally returned to us here on the Herald's Horn. All right, run the theme song. And welcome back. As usual, we are going to launch directly into the news. We have a great couple different news topics today. Most of them focused on competitive Magic the Gathering, just like we like it around here. This last weekend was DreamHack Dallas Regional Championship. It was won by Adam Weiss on Gruul Aggro. I gotta say, I love seeing so soon after OTJ release, I love seeing like a Swift Spear slick shot show off. Like Fugitive Codebreaker, you know, all of these basically brand new cards, more or less, just like immediately making a massive impact. Oh, yeah. Also, Demonic Ruckus, of course. Mm. The great 2 CMC aura enchantment gives the enchanted creature +1/+1 menace and trample. And then if it's put into the graveyard from the battlefield, draw a card. Yeah, seems pretty good to me. Oh, you can also plot it for a single red mana as well. So it costs a single red mana, is a great enchantment, replaces itself if it dies. Maybe they finally figured out a playable aura enchantment. But yeah, this great Gruul deck won RC this weekend. The RC this weekend was very, very intriguing, very interesting. A lot of stories coming out of the weekend, some of which we would love to talk about today. How do you feel about Gruul Aggro, Emma? This was standard, right?
Yeah, it's a standard RC. This will be the last big standard event, these RCs, for standard, which is a shame because standard's in a really good spot right now.
Yeah, this deck is made up of like a whole bunch of cards that were like technically legal for the last big Pro Tour, but people just hadn't had the time to cook with this stuff yet.
Well, this is it because Seattle Pro Tour was just so shortly after OTGA's release, so innovation was really hard to come by, which is why Esper Midrange was the most represented deck at the Pro Tour, because it's the safe bet of the format.
Yeah, like the effect of the shortness was like really cool for limited and less cool for standard.
Yeah, so, it's just...
win some, you lose some.
And when standard has a card pool of like 3,300 cards, you need time to like innovate. But no, Gruul Aggro, or Gruul Paress as it's also known, it's a really sweet deck. A very similar build is also doing well in Pioneer right now, because you still have Slickshot Showoff, you have Monastery Swiftspear, you have Ruckus, you have Audacity, which is really sweet as well. It's easily one. Slickshot Showoff, alliteration there, is just like one of the best constructed cards from OTJ so far, I think. And it's just sick that it's just innovated an archetype all on its own.
It is. I think it is kind of... I'm not shocked that like the better hot dog, I can't even remember hot dog's original name. Yeah, Killed Fiend. People were talking about that on Twitter today. Some WotC employee told a story where they were like, guys, what is Bob's actual card name? Please, I can't remember. It's Dark Confidant. I've started to do that with so many random cards. Like, yes, hot dog? No, that's Killed Fiend. I am not surprised that what I would personally call a more powerful Kiln Fiend has ended up being quite good in multiple formats.
And a Kiln Fiend with wings.
Yes, exactly. It flies. You can plot it so you can play it for free on your next turn, which leaves you a bunch of mana to immediately fire off a bunch of non-creature spells with. What's not to like?
Right. It's a great card.
Too. Whew, crazy card. The rest of the top eight... a lot of Boros Convoke, three Boros Convoke players. In fact, there was a five color Legends, which I think most people would just call a Slowgurk deck, like five color Slowgurk. There was, of course, also Azorius Control and a Gruul Ramp deck, which I thought was really cool and really interesting. I know that deck's kind of been on the rise, but play a bunch of lands. Play out Calamity, Galloping Inferno, make copies of your Terror of the Peaks, make copies of your Trumpeting Carnosaurs, make copies of your Topiary, you don't want to make copies of your Topiary Stomper, probably, but really interesting ramp deck, a lot of cool stuff going on there. Great, great top eight, really.
Yeah, it's fairly diverse, outside of the three copies of Boros Convoke.
Yeah, three copies of Convoke, yeah.
I think that surprised me the most, considering you had the big scorecard. The name escapes me, but it's an Orzhov card that can wipe cards. It's a board wipe for one CMC or less, one mana value or less.
Pest Control.
That's the one, yeah. Like, Pest Control's on the rise a bit with, like, Esper and stuff, but no, it seems a fairly diverse top eight, all things considered.
Looking at the list here, I had to go down to 15th to find my first Esper deck, which is kind of, unless this deck that's called Standard is also an Esper Legend deck, it is not. So... 15th first Esper Legends deck, in the top 25, I'm not seeing another one. I'm looking. Okay, there's a lot of decks called Standard now. I'm no longer opening up deck lists. But I was kind of surprised to not see as much Esper here, but I think that was because a lot of people made the determination in the testing time they had that while a safe pick, it was just actually a lot worse power level wise of a pick than Boros or Gruul or five color or Azorius or modern red, whatever you want to play. Oh, we have Esper tokens here at 21st. That totally counts. That's, right?
Yeah.
No, there is Rafine. Okay. Yeah. This is just a differently named Esper deck. Never mind. Okay. But yeah, I do gotta say, I think what you mentioned about this being like our last chance to look at standard, this standard in a big context, It is definitely saddening. I tweeted about it around the time of the Pro Tour too, because watching the Pro Tour was awesome. This is an incredible standard format. I was pretty busy this last weekend, but I did get to tune into some of the RC coverage, and the games rocked. Turns out that having a really big card pool can lead to a lot of fun and dynamic gameplay with a lot of different decks. It has been nice that, there seems to have been deck and archetype and viable deck evolution with the release of almost every single set over the past couple of sets. And it's just been a long time since we've seen something like that. And I'm pretty sad that now we just have to shift away to what Pioneer. That's everyone's got to pick up their Pioneer deck now and figure out whether or not it's right to play Phoenix. That's what we're doing now. Okay. I mean, so sure.
So is that a mono green? Mono green's back.
Can we ban Nykthos a second time?
But the biggest, like the saddest part about the current like RCs is, sure, this is like the last biggest standard event. It's also the last biggest standard event of this rotation because Bloomberry triggers standard rotation on August 2nd.
It's been so long. Was the release of New Kamigawa, was that the last set release that triggered a rotation?
Rotation, I believe. It's been 3 years. So when rotation triggers, both Innistrad sets go out, Kamigawa goes out, Streets of New Capella goes out. So you're going to lose all the Triumphs, you're going to lose Besieger, you're going to lose Raphine, you're going to lose all Slowgurk, you're going to lose, you know, Blood Type Harvester as well. Yeah. So there's a lot going.
Voldaren Epicure, pretty relevant.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff going.
A bunch of random good stuff in there. I think like a lot of the core from Boros specifically will still be around, save like Voldaren Epicure. It'll be interesting to see if that can stick around. Anyways, but Voldaren Epicure is an extremely good card.
It's a banger of a card.
Very, very hard. Very hard to replace. Two, like, higher level, kind of meta level things that could be said about this RC as well. MTG Melee broke during it. I just think that's kind of funny. I mean, it's funny, like, not in a good way. Kind of just like, oops, the more things change, the more things stay the same. We can never go we've never really been able to get through a huge competitive event without whatever software is running it, whether it be the old stuff or the new stuff breaking.
Someone losing match slips, like, doesn't even have to be tech. Like,
yep, exactly. Just like, it's, you know, it turns out when you have 1,000-something people trying to compete and getting it all going in the correct direction, get it all moving in a timely manner, shit's hard.
Very hard.
And I think kind of the biggest maybe meta level thing here is that this was the final DreamHack run regional championship. DreamHack, it was definitely an interesting experiment to hand the reins over to DreamHack, a very established, I would say, brand in the like convention space, but not really one known for running Magic events. And it does kind of feel like by the final one, they largely kind of knew what they were doing, but there's a pretty big growth period there. And I mean, if we're going to be honest, when it was given to DreamHack, there wasn't really anyone else to hand it off to at the time anyways. So.
No, and even then, like, DreamHack was already an event anyway. They just tacked on this RC on top of it. And while that's cool, because if you like, if you're in the RC and you're not playing anymore, you can do the DreamHack stuff. You can look at, you know, all the games or whatever. But it did feel a little weird when you have this big eSport gaming event and then you just have this little tabletop event tucked over in the corner. It feels very alienating and very weird. But I haven't attended one of these events, but just I'm looking at it.
It is kind of interesting because that is the context that a lot of other games like interact with their competitive scene through. Like DreamHack, it's a convention for a lot of different games where a lot of different big events take place. But I think Magic is just like very used to being its own thing. So it's definitely weird for us to have it included in other stuff. Well, the good news or the bad news, whatever you think about it, we're going back to being our own thing. SCG is now taking over the regional championship circuit for the US. I guess this is all for the US. This is couched in this only being for the US. As we all know, everyone who listens to this podcast and who hosts this podcast is purely US focused.
I'm US adjacent at this point.
US adjacent focused at this point. Yeah, exactly. Next up is RCDC in October, and it will be run by Star City Games. Every RC moving forward will be a part of an SCG con, much like Pro Tours and World Championships are part of Magic Cons. However, I think the RC will almost certainly be the biggest thing going on at these SCG cons, if I had to guess. 1,000-player tournament, it's quite a lot of people. And they're now also splitting it up to two RCs per year, per season, I should say. Historically, there has been one US RC feeding into the Pro Tour per season. Now there will be two. Thoughts, Emma? How do we feel about two?
I think it's good. Yeah. I think it's good. Like, it's a net positive. I think if you can get these RCs to be less 1,300 person events and more like 800 person events, then that's good. While there isn't a lot of information from SCG about this new two RC per season, they will be on at different times, so they're not going to clash on the same weekend or whatever. So it sounds like you can qualify. You have to qualify for two of them, and you can have two shots again on the Pro Tour, from what I can gather. But they'll have more information soon. My hope for SCG is that they do it in two different regions, because that is the biggest problem.
That seems like the obvious thing to do to me. Like, you have the West Coast RC and you have the East Coast RC.
Yeah.
And if you really want to qualify for and travel to both, you can. But it doesn't mean you have people from the West Coast having to fly all the way out to New York. Doesn't mean you have people from Maine having to fly all the way to Dallas or, you know, whatever.
And then get stuck in Dallas in a time loop based on the tweets I saw this weekend.
Yeah, every single person I know had a heck of a time getting into and a heck of a time getting out of Dallas this last weekend.
Yeah, sounds like
flight
a terrible
cancellation
place.
Galore. Yeah, let's just not go to Dallas. Sounds like a bad place. No one should go there. No reason to, obviously. So we're officially in the Star City Games Regional Championship era now. It's a really it's a really big change for the scene. I think I saw someone talking about the two RCs model we'll go to now. The biggest change I think about it is that probably anticipating that, like you said, they will probably each be smaller. Rather than having one RC where the top 64 all goes to the Pro Tour, these two RCs, the top 32 of both of them, will go to the Pro Tour. So I think it's interesting, because I think it'll probably, if I kind of just assume that, like, the grindiest grinders who really want to get on the Pro Tour will go through the work and through the monetary cost of qualifying for and then attending both of them. And then it kind of makes it, if you're able to do that, it makes it that you don't actually have to run, you don't have to spike. You don't have to, like, super spike an event. You don't have to get lucky at one event. You can get lucky at one of two events instead. And I think that the more that we can kind of get to a system that helps incentivize consistent performance rather than randomly spiking of events and then having to continue randomly spiking events. Random is the wrong term, but there's a lot of variance encased within Magic the Gathering, right? If we can find a system where Andrea Mangucci can consistently stay on the Pro Tour, I think we will have...
No. I'll go one better than that.
Oh.
Get Nathan Stoyer on the Pro
Yes,
Tour.
Yes, correct, yes.
Former world champion of Magic, who had that insane run last year, is not on the Pro Tour.
Is currently not playing in Amsterdam, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Or is he off after Amsterdam?
I think he's off after Amsterdam, but...
So, yes. So, chance, if he's live in Amsterdam, chance of requaling. But, yes, there's...
I mean, the only reason Mengu managed to qualify for the last two Pro Tours is because he did the last chance RCQ on the Sunday at the Pro Tour.
Yeah, at both the last two Pro Tours. Exactly.
It's insane.
And I don't exactly think we need to go back to, like, the Pro Point system, which was really good at ensconcing the exact same people in the position and made it harder actually for newer people to break in. I don't think we need to have some kind of system like that. But if the more that we can make the entire system worldwide, not just in the US, amenable to staying on the train longer without having to, like, finish super well. And I mean, even Nathan Stoyer, he did super well last year.
It's better for Wizards in terms of marketing as well, because you can create these narratives with these players and people can be like, wow, that Nathan Stoyer guy is really cool. He's, like, young. That's really aspirational. I want to be like Nathan Stoyer. And then you're like, where is he? Why is he not on this Pro Tour? He's like, oh, yeah, he didn't qualify. And it's like, what? But that's the point. It's really hard for Wizards to market these pro players if there's just not a consistent group of people on the circuit, which it's a problem.
Yep. So I love to see this change. Oh, they also unveiled some promos.
Oh, yeah, the ones that you can't read.
More promos that you can't read. Emma's favorite thing that you could possibly
and have. Another Nexus of Fate that's in foil that you is going to be curled to oblivion.
Is every Nexus?
I think some of them are foil. So you have the Core 19 Biobox promo, which you can only get in foil, which had that really fun period in Standard where people were playing the card, but they had to use Basic Mountain as a proxy because it curled, because they were the only foils you can get. Then you had the Secret Lair one, which was like a very similar to the Tales of Middle-earth poster cards.
Yeah, real funky.
Really, it's in red, but it's a blue card. Explain that to me. And then you've got this one, which is just ineligible as hell. And I'm like, what are you doing, bro? And these are to competitive players. Like, competitive yep. players aren't going to play these because nope. you can't read what the hell they are on the other side of the table.
It's like, maybe the sleight of hand one. The sleight of hand one is just like...
Sure.
It's the text is quite... It just doesn't have a normal Magic frame, but the text and layout is like much more legible. The other ones... No, the other two, the Supreme Verdict and the Nexus of Fate, no chance.
Don't get me wrong, they look cool as like art pieces cool. and yep. posters, but they should not be they should not be game pieces. But the thing is, like, even if these are for competitive players for like qualifying for RCs or whatever,
yep.
competitive players aren't going to play them, but will collectors want them? Which is the reason you sell these promos in the first place.
Exactly. It is kind of weird because like. If these are in demand from Commander players or collectors or whatever, then these will have value. And then it's kind of like, rather than having a sentimental promo that you can keep your hands on or use in your future decks, you do get some extra cash. So I don't know where the line is there. It would be nice if we could have cool and legible and playable in our competitive decks promo cards.
They did.
They did.
They had like the Ugin from the last RC promo, which is sick. Like very it's cool. just cool new art.
And it's like, alas. It is very cool that Supreme Verdict is just
an not incredible... Not a blue-white card.
No. It is an incredible homage to the Godzilla Destroy All Monsters movie poster. That's awesome, but with all Lycoria monsters, like that's cool, but it's not exactly. Yeah, it's got all the different legendary dudes on it, which is fun, but doesn't exactly. I don't think we'll see Gabriel Nassif casting that anytime soon. It is what it is. Emma might put WotC in hot water over the use of this art, but at least this art was created by humans. Wizards of the Coast once again landing themselves in a spot of trouble over the weekend, over the last week, for a job posting of theirs that somebody dug up. It was a job listing for a principal AI engineer. Ooh, I'm sure that went over well on Twitter.com. Wizards was looking to hire for designing and building systems, quote, for intelligent generation of text dialogue, audio, art assets, NPC behaviors, and real-time bot frameworks. They also emphasized that the person would need, quote, proven experience with AI/machine learning systems in at least one of the following areas: simulation, asset creation, and generative content. There was also a throwaway line in there too that a lot of people like to dunk on, that was like, you need to be aware of the ethical issues with using AI and be willing to help us communicate how we interact with that. So I'm sure we all know how this went. This it did not go well for Wizards of the Coast to try to be hiring for an AI engineer. Emma, what is your thought of AI in the pursuit of creativity?
So we talk about AI or we talk about machine learning?
Well, I would say more specifically, because of course there is quite a few potential uses for generalized AI and machine learning in some of these spaces. How do we feel about generative AI a la ChatGPT or perhaps art creation?
Considering people in my field of journalism and written content are losing their jobs due to generative AI, fairly strong on the subject. But with this whole thing with Wizards, so it's not to do with D&D, it's not to do with Magic, it's to do with the video game stuff, which doesn't make it good. I'm just saying, it's not infringing on D&D or Magic or whatever, it's part of their video game stuff. But the problem is, no matter how much companies promise that they won't use generative AI because it's, you know, it has such a horrible taboo at this point, there are just people that at these companies that are paid way too much that really believe in AI. So they're just going to keep pushing openings until something happens. Like the message of the company could be like, no, we don't want this stuff. Like we're going to be honest and transparent about this stuff. But it could take like a CEO or someone seems to go, I want an AI person because I'm convinced this is going to do well. And this is what's happened. Probably. Like you're seeing it across multiple companies right now where people are just like leaning super hard into the AI thing because people kind of know it's going to blow up soon. So they're just trying to get something out of it before it goes. Like, look at the whole Google AI stuff. That's just crashed.
It's not spectacularly. Gone well. It's not gone well. Google search AI is not
It's just
well.
A trend with like big billion corporate companies at the minute. So it's no surprise to see Wizards falling for this again because they've probably just been told to advertise it.
I think like, yeah, I buried the lead here a little bit. Watsi did clarify. I have a quote from Wizards of the Coast here. The website Comic Book reached out to them and they gave them a statement. Our stance on AI hasn't changed, Wizards of the Coast told Comic Book. I took this from the Comic Book article. I'll link it in the description if you want to check it out. This job description is for a role for future video game projects. And of course, this was actually clarified very quickly. And I saw it on my like Twitter timeline almost immediately after it started like blowing up, like once people started talking about it. But of course, people didn't care. And kind of like for the reasons you said, I don't really blame them, right? Like even if there was never going to be like another piece of AI or whatever, you know, used, if even if there wasn't going to be generative AI used for Magic or Dungeons and Dragons or what have you, like they have currently promised and may walk back at any time, I'm sure. I think it is very indicative to me how little people like trust Wizards of the Coast or whatever at this point, that like as a company or, you know, a company owned by Hasbro or how Hasbro may, cause Wizards of the Coast to operate, all those caveats, right? It's very how the reaction was to this, even though there was like immediately a fairly widely known correction from Wizards of the Coast about what
their comms was good. The communication was strong. It was good.
Like, exactly. But
as much you can be upset, but their comms was really good for this because they anticipated it. Obviously,
you have to. Their comms were real good for it, but it like still didn't actually matter because the trust from especially the D&D community, but also to some extent the Magic the Gathering community, is so degraded that people said, I saw people saying like, you know, I bet it's not for a video game position. I bet that's for D&D. Just like, you know,
I bet they're lying. There is probably merit to having someone with AI experience as a background to track and clamp down on it.
Yeah. Like that
from like a, from like getting content
to do it.
Or you know, like say you paid an artist and they used AI and it just went under the cracks. It might there might be some merit to have someone just to like veto that stuff and just be like, no, this is AI, we can't use this.
Certainly. Like if Wizards of the Coast put up a job listing that was like AI engineer. But then the thing was like, actually, we need you to know a lot about AI so you can help us catch the use of AI in our creative work from our freelancers. That would be fascinating. That would be
a really progressive and good way to hire someone for that job.
Yeah, certainly. And it is kind of tough, too, like because AI of one form or another, not generative, can actually really be helpful in video game dev. Like artificial intelligent processes and machine learning processes are instrumental in like making some people's jobs easier and making the background systems of video games like literally operate.
I saw like, a tweet ages ago that was, I want machine learning to do my laundry and taxes, not make me do more laundry and taxes because it's doing my job.
Yes, exactly. Like that's the, when we get to the point where we like are just only seeking to replace like creativity rather than the drudgery of life with artificial intelligence and automation and this kind of stuff. It's just like, what are we doing here? Like I love to write and I love to think about music and my wife Jen loves to make art but we do these things like not, you know, I do write some because I get paid, but I also love to write because I have thoughts in my head and I find joy in expressing them well. And you know, Jen, as much as she doesn't like the process of creating art sometimes, because it's insanely frustrating, it turns out I think it's a lot better for you mentally, self-improvement-wise, et cetera, if you actually put in the work to just do the thing rather than trying to get something else to do it for you. I don't know. That's just me, though.
I agree.
No, Emma, this is where you're supposed to say, actually, I think ChatGPT is a good thing.
It's not, because it's probably going to take my job at some point.
Ah, so. Shoot. I was hoping to get a little blackmail on you. Kidding. All right. That's enough about talking about AI. That's enough about talking about competitive magic. We got to get back to the real reason we're here, and that's talking about Magic the Gathering things you can buy. It's time for the Product Watch.
Oh, my God.
Welcome back to the Product Watch. Dan isn't here this week, and that's what, you know what that means? It means we get to talk about Magic the Gathering cards. No, that's just silly timing. Dan's gone, but the releases have resumed. We got 1 month off, basically, the month of May. No Magic the Gathering releases of note, but we're back. It is Modern Horizons 3 pre-release weekend this weekend. Your local Modern, Legacy, Vintage, and Commander rotating set has finally arrived.
Hey, don't get Popper.
No, and Popper too. Will they ban the new All That Glitters before or after Popper Geddon? The jury is out on that one. The jury is out on that one. Popper format panel member Emma Partlow in the dark. Oh, she's zipped up her lips and locked up the key. We can't talk about anything else this episode. Thank you so much for listening to them. You know, Emma, I do gotta say, I am kind of surprised, at least from my less educated eyes, and the way that I think about Magic cards, Modern Horizons 3 does, as a whole, at first blush, look less, like, super widely impactful on, like, Modern, Legacy, etc., than the last two sets have been. I know, like, the flares are dangerous. I said this on a previous podcast episode, and I'll say it again. My card evaluation is not quite there because I saw, you know, the blue flare denial, right?
Yep.
I was like, who would want to sacrifice a non-token blue creature? That's just such a high cost. And then I was listening to the Jerry T podcast, and Jerry T was so mad about it. He was like, do you know what are blue creatures? Narc Amoeba and Price Amalgam. Yep. What are we doing here? I was like, oh, brother. You're so right.
Merfolk, like you can bend some crappy merfolks off.
Certainly.
And turn it into a cancel.
Emma, I was saying there wasn't very many powerful cards, and you started like cackling and obviously looking stuff up. What am I missing here? What am I missing here, Emma?
So I was watching Aspiring Spike and Young Dingo, streamers. They're doing like a sort of versus live kind of with like MH3 cards and just brewing up decks. So there's some really cool stuff coming. So I think the new Tamiyo is quite good. The one mana Tamiyo that can flip into a planeswalker. You got Ugin's Labyrinth, which is also pretty cool, which is the ancient tomb, as long as you have a seven mana spell that you can exile with it. I think Ugin's Binding is fairly fun for Commander because it's a Cyconic Rift that you have to play a seven drop to like trigger it. The flares are good. I think what's the name of the card? Sorry. Primal Prayers, which is the Alluring with energy. Also could be fun because there's some cool combo stuff you can do with it.
Yeah.
With like Asarak.
About one.
You can do Asarak combo a lot more fun with that one.
I do love that for this set they were like, all right, you know, all those really busted cards from a long time ago, most of which are on the reserved list. Good news. We quote unquote fixed them with energy.
Yeah. You got Chthonian Nightmares, which is recurring nightmare for energy. Mm-hmm. You got Flaze, Titan of Fire's Fury, which is a lightning helix on a 6/6 or an Inferno.
Awesome.
Awesome design.
That.
Mason Clark, good friend of mine, designed the card from top to bottom. Great card. And you also got Nadu, Winged Wisdom. I know everyone's talking about this card for Commander. I think it might have some legs in like a Blink deck in Modern or like a Cephalid Breakfast style deck in Modern. The card's just bonkers. It's like, and also you got fetches. The fetches are reprinted, so you should buy your fetches when MH3 comes out as well. Like, there's a lot of like to like about the set. My issue with Modern Horizons 3 is that I am getting Commander Masters Whiplash.
Yes. Why is that? Do you think it's like too commander focused, or
it just feels very similar?
The demand is not there, or
so this is a weird one for me because I look at these sets with like a fine tooth comb because I have to know these products.
It's my job. Yeah.
At TCGP, I have to write this stuff or whatever. I'm just seeing a lot of comparisons from Commander Masters to Modern Horizons 3, and it feels like some of the stuff they couldn't put in Commander Masters, they're putting in Modern Horizons 3. So, for example, you have you got the Borderless Profile cards, they're in Commander Masters. You got the Medallions, which were also in Commander Masters. You also have the Eldrazi, which were also in Commander Masters. You have the Commander Precons, and the Eldrazi Precon is probably the best one out of the lot. Which also happened with Commander Masters.
And it's just also like double the price of all the other ones.
It's a premium set as well. Yeah. And a lot of the reprints feel very similar within the, like, not even a year, because I think Commander Masters was like August last year. But no, it just feels very similar. And I'm like, am I getting whiplash? Am I going insane? Am I just like too zoned in and tunnel vision on this stuff?
Now that you think, I didn't really even think about a lot of the comparisons. Now that you mention it though.
It's just like, am I just getting deja vu?
Yeah.
I'm probably going to write like an op-ed on it because I've got some thoughts about it, but it's just like, I just hate how Commander's taken the forefront of a set that is modern.
Yes. It's in the name. Modern Horizons 3 is in the name.
Right.
Well, I mean, even when when I've looked at the cards, you know, cause I was poking around the set some this week cause I'm working on a, not to get too inside baseball or whatever, but I'm working on a pre-con upgrade guide. And I was like, oh, I love putting cards from the set into, you know, that aren't in the deck, into the deck. Why not? It's usually synergistic because the pre-cons usually share the theme. Every single, like, commander-relevant card in this set is so expensive.
Pre-orders prices do inflate things, and it's really hard to, like, gauge prices. But yeah, the prices, even for, like, a week before release, the prices seem pretty high.
Well, I was like really surprised by like Ulamog the Defiler, right? I don't think that's exactly a card that's going to be tearing the house down in a constructed format per se.
Probably not, but
there are plenty of 10 mana colorless things for Tron to mess around with, right? And it is currently pre-ordering as the most expensive card in the set. And
it's just like, my biggest bugbear is just, it just feels like a commander set.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's just like, it's like Flare of Denial, Nethergorith, Ugin's Labyrinth, Ugin's Binding. Sure, these things very well, probably going to be played in a competitive setting. But a lot of this other stuff, Echoes of Eternity, Kozilek, Emrakul, Necrodominance
is kind of sweet.
That's either going to be real. It's either going to be real broken or real not. We'll find out that real soon, I'm sure. But so much of the stuff that's at the top here is just commander cards, and they're all the mythics, except for Phyrexian Tower, which also, you know, that's probably just going to break something in half too. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, the fun thing with Phyrexian Tower is that you can play Grief turn one with your Phyrexian Tower, and then you can sacrifice it with your Votrig on the staff and get some mana.
Wow, that is so fun, Emma. I'm having so much fun thinking about how great of an experience that is.
Your Grief now is 2 mana.
No. Boo. Boo. All right. So, Emma, I look forward to reading that op-ed. I think there's a lot of, definitely very interesting new things to be said along those lines. Because, it has been very interesting to me. Like, this set does almost feel like it has a lot of, like, it has maybe like a split personality. And a lot of sets have kind of played the game of, oh, there's stuff for Commander in here, and there's stuff for constructed formats in here. Because, like, that is just kind of how Magic has operated for most of the last decade. Once they started saying, oh, we can make cards for Commander, and people will like that. But this does just feel like
so many of the rares.
Yeah, so many of the rares, so many of the heavy hitters are just, like, random EDH playables that are...
It's like Kalian, like... Breya in this set. It's like, why?
I think a weird side effect of that feeling is that, like, they have used these sets to, like, make new cards for iconic characters in the past and be referential to things that are now iconic in Magic. And even much more so than, like, especially by the time the first Modern Horizons came out, like the things that are iconic in Magic now do kind of tend to be aimed more towards Commander. And so it does get harder and harder to be like, oh, we're going to do the iconic Magic thing without incidentally brushing up against Commander. But they very easily could have made a Kalia of... They very easily... Like, yeah, why are we reprinting... Straight up reprinting Kalia directly in Modern? Like...
It feels like when I saw the
cool deck with that, maybe I don't
think
so. When
I saw the borderless printing, it's wild to think cards like Kali and Bray are going to be like bulk mythic rares in this set.
Yeah, and they just incidentally are.
And but, when seeing the borderless treatments, I'm like, how much were these meant to be in Commander Masters and just got pushed like to the next set? I'm not saying that that happened, but it makes you think.
Yep.
I'm just like...
Well, and we already got a really cool Double Masters promo of her, too, not that long ago. Double Masters... Well, no, Double Masters 1 was a while ago at this point.
I do wonder how much conversation Hasbro has in these sets, because I wouldn't be surprised if Hasbro goes, this needs to have Commander set, this needs to have Commander focus, because Commander, goes makes number go up, so you need to incorporate this.
Yep. That's always the tough conversations. We simply... don't know. Speaking of Hasbro directives, Emma Partlow, Assassin's Creed previews start on June 18th.
They do.
Universes Beyond League Modern Legal sets continue to arrive, with Assassin's Creed being the next one. Can you tell me anything about these packs? Do you happen to know how these packs will work off the top of your head?
So they're called Beyond Boosters. I believe they are 7-card packs. Mm-hmm. And they aren't Aftermath boosters, but they sound a little bit like Aftermath boosters. I think they're meant to give a more better experience. You got to realize these packs are meant for people who haven't played Magic before or looking to pick it up for the first time. So these packs are going to be geared towards, oh, wow, you know, I've got all these packs full of assassins or something. It feels very set boostery, but with less cards is kind of the idea that I'm getting from what I've heard from Wizards. I don't know if it's true. We'll find out in a few weeks. But yeah, you got set boosters, you got collector boosters, you got a starter kit, which is really cool because those tend to do well for Wizards. The LTR one did really, really well because it just got a ton of people into Magic.
Do you know what's in the starter kit?
I believe it's 2 decks. One's a Boros one, one's a Dimir one, but I can't remember the people because Assassin's Creed characters all blend into one for me.
And 95% of them are just like weird historical characters. And
right. and I think there's like a bundle as well, and that's it. There's no Commander precons, not standard legal or anything like that.
See, I do almost wish, I mean, I'm sure licensing was part of it too, but I do almost wish that, like, of the sets that were coming out this summer, I do wish it was like the Assassin's Creed set that had the Commander decks rather than Modern Horizons 3.
There is a secret lair coming of Assassin's Creed that could be a Commander precon. Wizards have done it before. Probably not. Yep. I think that's probably a bit risky. Who knows? But it's going to be cool. You got 100 cards, 80 cards in you, 20 are reprints. Some will see play in Modern, some won't.
Yep.
Engage with the set as you see wish.
Yeah, and I think it'll definitely be... I wouldn't doubt if they, like, maybe pitch under a little bit on the power level of stuff, because, like, this is technically going to be Modern legal, but I think, like, the ideal is that it just mostly ends up in Commander anyways, and then...
It's Commander and kitchen table.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, we put Modern Legality on this just so we could make a whole set without it, like, crashing. And, you know, we have to have somewhere to play these cards. That's not just Commander. Yeah. And
I think it'll do well.
Yeah. I have seen a lot of, like, doom and gloomers on the timeline that are like, wow, I can't believe we're this desperate for IP that we're doing Assassin's Creed. Assassin's Creed is still,
it's
like...
big.
Top five best-selling video game series.
There's a game coming out in November.
Is a game coming out in November, and it'll be one of the best-selling video games of the year. Like, people still really like this series.
A good franchise.
Yeah, even if, like, me, you've left it behind to, like, play more indie stuff or whatever, you know, when I'm feeling a certain way, I will boot up Assassin's Creed.
I remember playing Assassin's Creed 2 and getting annoyed about all the feathers I had to bloody find, you know, as we all did when we all played Assassin's Creed. The first
Ubisoft collectathon.
Yeah. Good times.
Yep, exactly. Speaking of things that Emma Partlow likes, maybe we should move on to the co-host notebook.
Ooh, Oh, yeah. So you've been playing Dave the Diver, which I'm really happy about, by the way.
I have been. I've been playing Dave the Diver, and yet I think I kind of ran out of motivation for it in Chapter 2.
That's what happened to me as well. Yeah. I still need to go back to it. I downloaded the Godzilla DLC because there's some time DLC where you get to meet Godzilla or something, which sounds cool.
You have to do something with Godzilla. Yeah, that's what got me to download it. I saw Godzilla DLC and I was like, I love kaiju. I'm going to download Dave the Diver.
So my hyperfixation at the minute is a game called The Last Spell. It is a roguelite meets dungeon defense game meets tactical RPG. Basically, the premise,
like, it's checking all the boxes.
Also, the soundtrack is great. It's metal meets synth.
Nice.
So the music slaps as well. So basically, the premise is you are in a post-apocalyptic world. This is like medieval times. There's zombies and monsters everywhere, and to break this curse, you need to cast something called The Last Spell. So what happens is there are multiple villages across this place, that this world, and you need to protect these villages from these monsters while these mages cast The Last Spell in each village. So your goal is to survive waves of monsters that come, and if they kill all the mages, The Last Spell is broken and you lose the game. It is very hard. You're meant to lose to begin with because it teaches you how to play the game, and you are going to die a few times. It's kind of like the Dark Souls of like tactical RPGs, because you're meant to lose, but you're also meant to learn from it. And then the goal is, like, in between waves of monsters, you build defenses for your settlement, you buy kit for your heroes, you can recruit more heroes, you can build stuff, you have actions, and then you just fight these monsters every wave until you hit to a certain knight, and then you fight a boss, and then that's done, and then the spell is broken, and then you move to the next sea. There's like five of them all together, but you play through them a lot because you're not going to get through them first time. And you get like power-ups as well to make it easier. So you get these things called omens, which are like passive abilities that you start with. So you can play it with a bunch of passive abilities if you just want to play the game without the difficulty. So they've scaled it that way, which is pretty fun. But I like the trial and error. But no, it's pretty fun. And it's like 16-bit high fantasy metal music. It's awesome.
That sounds awesome.
It's really good.
I'm looking at its Steam page right now because that sounds very up my
alley. It's good. It's very punishing, but it's good.
I do love roguelike games in general are awesome.
Yeah. Plus, that music slaps. I play it. It's like my gym playlist now. I just play it at the gym. It's just so good.
The soundtrack?
Yeah, it's good. It's nice. Really good. Like, even if you don't play the game, you should just check it out because it's just like synthwave metal stuff. It's
I love great. All that kind of stuff. So
yeah, it's
I'll
fun.
Definitely be doing that. Well, I'm glad you've been enjoying The Last Spell, Emma. Is there anything else in your co-host notebook, or should we wrap this thing up?
I'm done. Like, I've ranted You're about done. The Last Spell.
You're finished. Ranted about The Last Spell, ranted about Modern Horizons 3. What else could there be to rant about? Emma Partlow, soon to enter national service. All right, never mind.
Wow, deep cut.
All right, that's all we have for this episode of the Herald's Horn. Emma, anything to leave our audience with as we shut this thing down?
Yeah, don't join the national service.
Don't join the national service. You heard it here. Anti-England sentiment on this cast, as always. Thanks so much for listening. We have a great interview coming up. Thanks for listening. I'll say it again. Hey, it's me again, Cal. I hope you're really enjoying this episode. If you are really enjoying it, consider joining the Brass Section and supporting us on Patreon. For just $5 a month, you can help me pay my bills and also the bills of the co-hosts. You'll gain access to our supporter-exclusive show, Heraldic Banter, and you'll also get unceremoniously tossed into our Discord. Check out the link now in the podcast notes to toss us a few bucks. We really appreciate it. I am kind of continually amazed that at least in common parlance, Stan as slang does come directly from the Eminem song, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Yes, it 100% does. I was talking about it with, I think it was my friend Nick, and I mentioned it to him, and he was like, "What's Stan?" And I was like, "Well, it," and like I described it. Yeah, and he was like, "Isn't that Eminem song kind of like problematic and has like an abusive like fan celebrity relationship?" And I was like, "It's cool now."
Exactly. And so now this is of course relevant because there's a new Eminem single that came out last
weekend. I'm not prepared.
That's what I brought you on here to talk about today, Sam. I'm
not prepared. I've only heard that it's bad. I've only seen people making fun of it, so I have no idea.
I've seen people making fun of it, and I've seen people being like, "Wow, at least he's not using his new cadence with sucks." So
yeah, not at all. Not at all. It's really the Stan thing, and then beyond that, there's very little Eminem facts in me.
For a dollar, name a fact about Eminem.
Stan? Did I already mention Stan?
Ah, shoot! I should have disqualified Stan. That's on me.
Name a non-Stan fact.
A non-Stan fact about Eminem.
He was in the movie 8 Mile.
Oh, shoot. Name an Eminem factoid. He was in his own movie. Not there. Well, Sam, thank you for joining me on this episode of Daryl Torn. Great to chat with you.
Oh, yeah. Glad to be here. I hope all the tutors and duders out there are having a great time
tutors,
today.
Tutors and duders? I prefer the term trumpeter. No, we left that behind a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those were early days. I was trying to suggest horny heralds.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that really caught on.
There's a lot of innuendo adjacent jokes for potential names.
It's, yeah.
Like, do you regret? And I'm like, no. This is a PG-13 at most. I mean, I guess that can be PG-13.
Oh, yeah. It definitely podcast, can.
But then people are like, well, why'd you name it the Herald Torn? I was like, I didn't think about that. That's, you know, that's a you problem, not a me problem.
Yeah. Well, we call our listeners prospectors. And lots of people will say minors. And I'm like, nah, that can't be it. It can't be minors. But prospectors also gets us a lot of like crypto stuff. Every once in a while, I'll type prospectors into Twitter and these like crypto bots descend and they're like, oh, you're farming crypto?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm into that.
Nowhere.
I'm like, no, that's not it.
That's funny. Well, yes, Sam, host, co-host?
Host, technically. I'm very pedantic about the host co-host title within the Howling Song.
Okay. So, yes, okay. I'm kind of just keep burying the lead here over and over again. I must admit, Sam.
Yes.
Host of the Howling Saltmine podcast. Could you introduce yourself to the populace who may not know you listening to this podcast?
I would love to. So I host the Howling Saltmine podcast with my friend Mike and my friend Tony. And it is a weekly comedy advice podcast where we read salty stories from the Magic the Gathering community and talk about them, tell some jokes, and really like talk about what makes people salty in EDH specifically. Mm-hmm. We do talk a lot about other formats every once in a while. We get some stories from other folks. Yeah, you know, but for the most part, it's pretty focused on playgroup dynamics in Commander. And we've been putting up shows for almost 2 years now. We just hit our 100th episode a few weeks ago, had a big guest extravaganza, which was pretty fun. And it's a great time.
100 episodes. That's a big achievement. Did you miss a week? Did you miss any weeks? And
we never missed a week, which that's is
even
crazy.
More. That's even like more impressive than 100 episodes. Like, there's a lot of people I'm sure who get to 100 episodes weekly and along the way, they, you know, take Christmas off or New Year's off or you know, whatever, insert a holiday. But no, that's very impressive. Congrats on that.
Thank you. We talk about taking Thanksgiving off every year because our numbers suck ass on Thanksgiving because we're a Thursday release show like you guys.
Just like, yeah, it's like happy Thursday. Happy Thanksgiving. Here's a podcast. Yeah.
But our Canadian listeners and our international listeners love it.
Yeah.
They're like, we're not celebrating. Yeah, exactly. Come on, give us something.
Finally, a piece of content on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Fair but enough. Yeah, I mean, we're a pretty, you know, we swear a lot and we tell some like kind of, I guess you'd call it a dirty joke or two. Yeah, so yeah. It's not really something you want to like turn on.
Around with, the family.
Yeah, with yeah. grandma while you're digging into the sweet potatoes.
Yep, for sure, for sure. What if she's into EDH? Like, what if she's been mean at the EDH table? Give her a little lesson, you know?
Yeah,
Grandma, you need to listen to this. Let me show
Grandma,
you.
You're getting salty around the cribbage board. You gotta chill.
This reminds me of episode 55 of the Howling Salt Mine podcast, Grandma. Turn up your hearing aid. I've got something for you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you can translate a lot of those salty lessons to so many games. It's funny because we had an episode a while back where I was hanging out with my parents and playing some card game with them. I think it was Gin Rummy. Mm-hmm. And they were getting so fucking salty. It was like ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I was like, you guys
gotta chill.
I was like, this is where I get it from. And I was also like, this, I'm definitely talking about this on the podcast. Like, are you kidding me? This is gold right now.
Are you a leading salt lord yourself? Are you beholden to are you mining your own salt on the podcast? Is that where it came from? It's really
That's kind of the origins.
I'm a real salty guy. Yeah, what is the origin of the Howling Salt Mine podcast? Like, makes you sit down and say, oh, me and my two buddies are just going to do this?
So I've been playing with the same, like, dedicated play group for, I think, like, 4 years now, maybe 5 years now.
That's
and
nice.
We play weekly for the most part, and we do miss weeks. We're not as dedicated as the Howling Salt Mine podcast. Mm-hmm. Those guys are crushing it. As a play group, we flake constantly. But we started tracking our games one day in a big old spreadsheet and actually got like 2 or 3 years of data out of it, which was pretty fun. A couple games a week over the course of a long time. And as we were playing games, at a certain point, we noticed that we were just getting so salty. It was sucking a lot of the fun out of the game. Me in particular, me and my co-host Tony are the two saltiest bastards on the show, easily. Mm-hmm. And I like to say that I'm somewhat reformed now, and I don't quite get as salty, but sometimes it still does come out. Mm-hmm. But we started tracking our games, and one of the things that we wanted to start tracking, we kind of started to track silly things, and one of the things that we started was the saltiest baby.
Saltiest baby this game goes to Sam.
Literally. Yeah. So we would finish a game and then we'd talk about who the saltiest baby was, and we would give that person a check mark, and it would roll up into all of our statistics because we're all a bunch of engineers.
Yep.
And met in engineering school. So it would roll up into our big statistics sheet. And, you know, when you see that you're a 27% salty baby,
yeah,
that makes you want to change.
You gotta chill out a little bit. Yeah.
You're like, one in four games I'm salting off. Like, that's not good.
No.
So we started to track that. We tracked, like, in our CDH games, we would track misplay bay, which was whoever had like the
biggest
most egregious misplay.
Yeah.
And then we would track like the archiest of enemies, because Tony was being the arch enemy all the time, and we needed data to back it up to kind of like,
we're just like, hey,
show him.
We actually have to prove to you that you are the problem. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
So that was an element in our play group. Mm-hmm. Then we just had a Discord where the four of us would hang out and mm-hmm. like chat about new cards and new decks and things like that. And one of the things that we started to do was find these funny, salty stories on Reddit and kind of share them with each other in our Discord. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everybody who's been on the EDH subreddit has seen a story. Oh, yeah, like
it's 80% of the subreddit at this point.
It literally, exactly. I got a lot of feelings about that too. Yeah.
but yeah, they're stealing my bit. No.
Well, they used to have like a dedicated Tuesday, like complaining day.
Yeah.
Maybe it was Monday mornings, I think it was called.
I don't like that.
I don't like that. Could use some brandy.
Hey guys, welcome to Monday. Welcome to Monday Monday here on the Horny Podcast.
Ha-cha-cha-cha-cha. So they used to have a dedicated space on the Reddit where people could complain. And then one day they were like, people don't engage with this. Let's get rid of this. And then now, like, the salty stories are just rampant. So yep. I got some beef with that, a little tangent there.
That's fair.
But basically, we would take these stories and share them with each other, and we just thought they were really funny. And I think every magic group out there that consumes magic content at some point asks themselves the question, why not me? What about us? Can we do it? Like, we have some kind of idea. Let's start filming our games. Let's start talking into microphones. Let's start doing something, right?
Yep.
So with us, I kind of pitched this idea like, hey, I think this could be a thing. We could call it the Howling Salt Mine. Mm-hmm. I think it's like a really interesting name. And we kind of kicked it around. It didn't really go anywhere. Then it was maybe like 5 or 6 months later, I went on my sister's podcast. She had a podcast for a few years called Let's Talk Nerdy. Mm-hmm. And I was out visiting her in Nevada and dropped in to do kind of like a guest spot where we talked about Thundercats and Captain Planet, as you do. And my sister-in-law heard that episode and was like, you just have a crazy voice for podcasts, man. You should
definitely
do this.
You've got the voice for it.
Yeah. And people have been telling me that my whole life.
Yeah.
And finally I was like, well, you know, I do have this idea. Like, maybe I'll just pull the trigger on it. Mm-hmm. So I got Tony and Mike together and we were like, let's just start recording a few episodes. And we got like 2 or 3 done and we didn't hate them, which was good. And I recorded our intro song, which really kind of made it stick. It's been the same intro song the whole time. Mm-hmm. If people haven't heard it, it's a little parody on the Final Countdown.
Can you vocalize it? That's a real big thing on the, can you do a little singing of your own podcast theme?
Oh yeah. It's the Howling Salt Mine. Are you
the vocalist on that one?
I do all the singing for the podcast.
Okay, I figured.
Not only do we have that song, we also have a unique song that we do for our Patreon shows.
That's fun.
That all of us actually sing on. And then every single week I sing a salty song. At the beginning, it just kind of became like a little ditty that we would sing between segments. Mm-hmm. Now they're like full blown produced song parodies that I'm doing off of like patron requests. Some of them are very high production value. Some weeks I kind of phone it in. Mm-hmm. But it's really evolved into this other thing.
You
which
sound like
is
a very
fun.
Busy man, Sam.
Yeah, I am. This is my job. I don't work.
Okay.
Podcasting full time.
Okay. That makes sense. I was headed that direction. I was like, so are you still an engineer or okay? Yeah. But you know, okay, the level of investment, the level of work makes a lot of sense now.
Yep. And I do all the art aside from mm-hmm. our like yeah. logo, which we had a tattoo artist who was a fan of the show just hit us up and be like, can I do some art?
We're
like, yes, please. I do all the art. I draw our tokens and stuff. So it's really like just this big labor of love. And we started with these Reddit posts and eventually started to get fan mail, mm-hmm. which is really cool. People sending in their salty stories. That was kind of
the inflection point. You're like, oh, people are listening and they're caring enough to actually participate.
Which was crazy because we would do these mailbag episodes where it would be like, hey, we finally have 3 salty stories from the listeners. Let's do an episode about it because we do 3 every episode. So we had these mailbag episodes, which were really, really fun. And those would be intermixed with the fully focused on Reddit episodes. And eventually the stories that we were receiving from people, I think it was maybe last year at the start of last year, the stories that we were receiving from people, we were like, we're getting so many, we need mm-hmm. to just put them into every episode. So we did away with the mailbag structure. And at this point, the stories have fully taken over. And sorry to people who are sending stories in. Mm-hmm. Please still send them in. But we're getting so many that
we can't actually like be fair to everyone anymore that we would like to be. Yeah,
we will never read them all. We're still reading stories from February right now with our backlog.
That's insane.
It's wild. We probably get like between five to, I don't know, maybe like five or six a week. So it just floods in, and it's a ton of fun. So now we get them from our patrons, we get them from our listeners, and the show's just kind of evolved from there. We have guests on occasionally. We try not to have it be like a guest focused show just because we're shit at scheduling just the three of us to get together. So that added element of like having another creator come on and hang with us is always a challenge. Sure. But it is a ton of fun when we get people on, and it's just been a really good time so far.
Heck yeah. I'm glad. And it seems to obviously be working out for you guys very well. I always like it. I always love hearing the stories that are like, yeah, we just decided to do something and then it really worked out. I mean, it helps that you guys are exceedingly fun and exceedingly competent and all those kind of things as well. But
yeah, a lot of people talk about like the friendship dynamic, and like I've been friends with Tony for over a decade. He's one of my best friends, and Mike and Tony live together for a long time. And then our friend Nick jumps on and like fills a seat if Mike or Tony is busy. And then we have our friend Pat who jumps on as well. So we have like some what we call our honored guest hosts who will pop on every once in a while, but we're just a super tight group of friends. And, I think that comes through in the banter and kind of the shit talk that we bring to every episode.
And I think that like incidentally is what ends up making so much, especially like EDH stuff end up being successful. Yeah. It's just like, actually a lot of people are into EDH in the first place for, you know, kind of what you were saying. Like, this is just your dudes you're playing with anyways, cause they're your buddies.
And
you
know exactly.
What? You know what? That's what a lot of people are into it for. So if you can like replicate that in interesting content that people are looking forward to, then POG.
Yeah.
to use a technical term, POG.
Yeah, that is a POG. That's what we would call a POG in the industry.
Big pogger, big pogging on the podcast there, Sam. Okay.
Yep. Big pogging. So now that big pogging in the mind.
Now that we've been talking for like 18 minutes, I guess I should ask you the first question that I ask everyone, right?
Oh yeah.
Sam, how did you start playing Magic the Gathering?
So I started playing Magic pretty late. I started playing in college. And it was something where one day I was leaving my apartment, a classic triple decker apartment in New England, and the guys who lived upstairs from me were playing Magic out on the porch. And I was like, oh, what is this? Like, I kind of recognize this game. And my roommate Juan was like, oh, I've played Magic. And we were with my friend Adam, and he was like, I played Magic too. And we were sort of like, maybe we should give this a shot. So the guys who lived upstairs from us just gave us a bunch of free cards. I remember like my first few cards were Boros Guildmage, and it was like back in Dissension time. Like but you could still buy pre-cons of like Saviors of Kamigawa at the LGS and stuff like that. So that's sort of like the time frame that we're working with. And we just started to build these like kind of crappy, janky 60 card decks and just played while we were, you know, Wastoid Zombies in college, and just partying and having a good time playing Magic like big nerds, at our engineering school. And it was super fun. And I actually, and around the same time, like Tony started getting into Magic as well. And he and I had like a combined play group. It was sort of like my apartment and his apartment and a handful of other nerds in our men's chorus that we would play with. And eventually we got into EDH, and I purchased, I think it was the Counterpunch deck, the Gave Guru of the Spores deck. And I still play Gave. Gave is still one of my favorite commanders.
Sick as hell.
Yeah, it's still gross. I just made a version that has no combos in it because it was
that's
unceremoniously
kind of
ending my game.
Actually,
yeah, it sort of is, and it's. I think it's maybe more annoying now that it doesn't have those combos.
Yeah, because then you just sit there and you're like, "Ooh, I'm gonna move around 1 million counters," and everyone's like, yeah. "Snooze."
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just like, "Well, I'll get the Seaborn Muse out," and they're like, "No." I'm like, "Well, on your end step, I'm gonna take 20 game actions."
So, Howling Saltmine, I was playing with my friend Sam the other day, and
yeah, that's the classic joke whenever we make somebody salty. There, I'm going to write in about you.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, you're like, the problem.
I would love for that story to come in. Like, please, that would be amazing.
Just like
to
read this story long that's about me. Story, and you're like, wow, this guy sounds like an asshole. And you get to the end, and you're like, it was you, Sam.
It's me.
It was you all along.
My comeuppance. I'm reaping what I sowed.
Comeuppance is a Magic the Gathering card that I don't know what it does.
It is. Yeah, I think it's like it deflects all the combat damage back. It costs 4.
Yeah, it's deeply mana. Weird. It's white. Yeah, it's white. I know it was a Sheldon favorite. That's all I know about it.
Yeah, it's one of those like white 4 mana instants that you probably cut from your deck.
Yeah, it's like you probably cut from your deck, but then like you're playing against someone and it absolutely BTFOs you and you're like, yes. Oh, come up in. And you put it into your deck and then you never cast it and you cut it. And
yep. Exactly. Then the cycle continues. But yeah, I got in college and I really didn't like EDH when I first got into it. Probably because I was a terrible deck builder. And I just remember the games being like 4 hours long, like a 4-person, 4-hour battlecruiser game. And it all culminated when I went to this convention, like a small local convention. I think it was called Captain Con in Connecticut somewhere. Anyways, I went there and it was super late at night and these people had an idea to play like an 8-person EDH game. And boy, that sucked. What a miserable existence.
I think that is one of the sneaky things about the way that EDH works is that like somehow both below and above 4 is like some miserable experience, but at 4 it like just works.
Yep, exactly. It's like at 5, it just becomes a little bit too big. There's a little bit too much interaction to fight through for things. And at 3, it becomes a little too,
Going on. Yeah, exactly.
It's too easy to like completely overtake a game in a 3-player game. Mm-hmm. But yeah, after that, I swore off EDH for years and played just 60-card jank and forced my friends to do the same. Mm-hmm. And then got back into EDH like right before COVID hit.
Classic.
Which is the classic move. And then me and the rest of the guys all got webcams and just played like 2 to 3 times a week during early COVID days and have kept it up ever since. And we're still playing weekly. So
that's so sick.
Yeah, it's been fun. I mean, I like it a lot. Magic is a great game. I love TCGs. They're just... I just love games in general. Rules in general are just so fun. Big gamer in general? Oh, yeah. I love games. Big gamer.
Second favorite game? It's obviously Spades, right?
Second favorite card game is Cribbage, for sure.
Okay, I've never ended up playing Cribbage.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe Dan hasn't forced you to play Cribbage, because Dan's a Cribbage guy.
Okay. I haven't hung out with Dan much up until this last weekend. So
yeah, I saw. I saw the picks.
Yeah, it was so fun. But, I know I play a lot of spades.
Oh, really? I can't say I've played lots of spades.
It's what our pals are. It's what our like less into gaming friend group here in Columbus. Like I have a really good friend group here in Columbus, but like very low on games that are not specifically spades, hearts, and poker. So we play a ton of that.
How about like gin or rummy? Do you get down with those?
I like gin. My wife Jen and I play a lot of like just like 2-player gin, and we have our like little lifetime score. Her destroying me. just like, oh, you won. Oh, I won one handed. You won 10. Okay, +500 for you winning the game, and +100 for every hand. It looks like you're ahead by another 2,000 points. That's crazy.
I'm
very bad at gin.
That's so funny. I love gin. I play gin with my mom mostly. And then my buddy Matt got me into Cribbage a few years ago. And it's the ultimate game for just like chilling, drinking a beer. You can play outside. Like it's very, very simple, but there's a high skill level.
Yeah.
But I also can't, there's still the element of luck. Mm-hmm. So I can't get so sweaty that I'm unpleasant to play against, which is a critical thing for me with games.
Yep. So not to make this podcast about me or anything, but, I know.
Well, you're the host.
That's true. I am the host and you're the guest. So you're subjected to whatever I want to talk about.
Exactly.
I don't even know how Cribbage works at all. My one interaction with Cribbage was after like an SCG Columbus event. Mm-hmm. Braden, previous EDH grinder, previous SCG employee,
market mover,
Braden, the market mover, was crashing at our place, and we were headed out, and he had driven in and was driving out with Ross Miriam, and we had to get him back with Ross, and so we met up for like breakfast, and the breakfast place was too busy, so we went next door to the Mexican place, which was awesome,
hell yeah,
and we were the only people there, but Braden, my wife Jen, and I all sat there and ate our Mexican food and talked to each other. And Ross Miriam sat there thinking about cribbage hands. He had a deck of cards and he was like, how would I play this cribbage hand? And that's what he did the whole time. And that's like the most TCG grinder thing I can think of somebody doing. They're like, I have a couple spare minutes before my food gets here. I'd run through some cribbage hands.
That's so good. Yeah, it's like running through mulligans for a CDH deck or something.
Exactly. And so like that's been my one interaction with cribbage is like notable Magic the Gathering player Ross Miriam sitting across from me at the Mexican joint running through cribbage hands and trying to explain what he's talking about to my wife.
Oh, that's so good. It's a lovely game. Very simple, but if you want to get to that like higher end, there is like a pretty high skill ceiling for sure.
For sure.
Because there is this like random element with it. Basically, I won't completely say all the rules of cribbage for the folks out there, but there's an element where a card gets flipped over on the top of the deck and it is going to feed into the cards in your hand and like synergize with them with like points and runs and two or three or four of a kind and things like that. So a lot of the hand, and you have to put two cards from your hand into a crib, which is sort of this blind side hand. So a lot of the game is like assessing what you should keep and what the chances of a card getting flipped over and how many points that could potentially get you. So there is that like element of really, really getting deep into a cribbage hand. If you like, usually I play cribbage pretty sloppily
on the phone app,
cribbage with grandpa. Oh, and I'm just grinding games on an airplane because I didn't pay for the Wi-Fi.
You're either like grinding cribbage games like in that scenario or you're like on the porch drinking a beer. And those are neither much of a place to be sweating.
Yep, exactly. So usually it's a pretty laid back game, but every once in a while you get pretty sweaty with it. But
would
it's
you,
a good
would
one.
Would you say that your cribbage experience then maps over to making you a better EDH player?
That's interesting. I think my EDH play makes me a better cribbage player.
Okay,
for sure.
That's fair.
Honestly, I think Magic the Gathering and understanding the rules of Magic the Gathering makes you a better gamer, period. I think it makes you better at digesting rule sets for complicated board games or card games or things like that. I think just the concept of the stack makes you better at like sequencing games that may not have that firm structure and have some ambiguity to them. So, I mean, it's definitely made me like voracious for games with overly complicated rule sets. Or even games with very simple rule sets that have complex interactions. Like Love Letter is my other favorite game. I don't know if you ever get down with Love Letter, but that game fucking rules.
I do play it from time to time. I've not played it as much as I would like to.
Oh, that is the classic game. Like that's probably tied for cribbage at number two with that's me. Fair. That's the game that like my wife and I go to a brewery and we bring Love Letter and we just jam hands of Love Letter over and over and over again.
I always forget to just like take it anywhere because like I have it. I actually have two copies of it because I did the real classic. Oh, I should surely have a copy of Love Letter, right? Get home. Oh, shoot.
We have a travel one and then we have one for home. So we just like keep
a little home and play one in the glove box and one on the board game shelf.
Like literally, we just like either keep it in my fanny pack, my backpack or her purse.
Yeah, and that's ideal.
And it's
even.
Just always there. So
you just always have it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's not to like? That's awesome. That's awesome. So Sam, what's in the future of the Howling Salt Mine? You have anything? You think you have anything planned? You have anything cooking? Or are you just going with the flow? You're just trying to make the best podcast you can, and if something comes, something comes.
That's an interesting question. I think that we're always kind of scheming for the future. You know, we talk a lot about YouTube content. We have no YouTube. We have a YouTube account. There's nothing on it.
Oh, you haven't even like done the lazy thing like I've done and like put up a blank video with audio?
We haven't. And yeah. I think it's because we didn't do it right from the get-go. So there was always a point where it was like, well, are we just going to upload like 40 episodes to YouTube and have 40 episodes with no views and people come across our account and be like, these guys suck. No one's watching these 40 videos. And now, of course, the problem has extrapolated out to 100 plus videos.
Yeah, like the problem only gets worse literally every week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I'm not a video editor at all. Like, I have audio editing background just as like a hobbyist making music and shit. Yep. So it's sort of this thing where it's like, that was so out of our depth just from the beginning that I never really wanted to tamper with YouTube. And now we've got nothing there. So I think maybe someday we'll do some kind of like YouTube shorts or clips or something like that. We also continue to kick around this idea of doing like a D&D occasional like D&D like audio podcast.
Oh yeah.
Because I love to DM and the guys love to play D&D and it just feels like a natural thing, but
this works.
Planning D&D takes a lot of time. So, you know, that's something that's like kind of on our back burner, but for the most part, we just continue to invest our content into the Patreon, just giving our patrons more and more content, giving them like tokens, giving them a lot of fun benefits and tiers, and making it so they feel like they can really interact with the podcast. And that has been, man, like the community that has risen up around the Howling Salt Mine is just unbelievable. Like when we went to Chicago, MagicCon Chicago earlier this year, a bunch of our patrons were there and then just a bunch of listeners in general were there. And just the feeling of like meeting the people in your community is unbelievable. It's just such a cool group of people. They're incredibly supportive, loving, fun to play Magic games with. I'm always just in awe that we... Like, I think that's the thing I'm the most proud of making with the podcast
for
the community.
It's like, you're making like, I don't want to say you're making a product or whatever, but that's what it could be viewed as, right? You're like making something because you want to make it. It could be conceived as a product, but like what makes it more than a product is that you have a group of people who care about you and the thing you're making and each other. And that's really cool. Yeah.
It's wild. It's very cool to see. And now like, some of our patrons are like getting together and hanging out in person and like forming real life friendships. And that is crazy. It like gets me all misty eyed. I love that.
That's so sick.
So, you know, I think future plans, we're just going to kind of keep doing what we're doing, keep investing in it. You know, we're just always hoping to get like more guests on the show. But again, we're such awful schedulers. So like getting that, I think we're our own worst enemies in that regard.
Scheduling is so tough.
We're still working through that stuff.
Scheduling is so tough. Not to put myself into the gutter here, but behind the scenes, I DM'd Sam 2 days ago when I was in Philly. And I was like, I was sitting in the car with Ian and Lua and Jen. And I was like, holy I had an entire week off of work, and do you know what I didn't do? Line up a Harold's Horn guest. You know who I've wanted to talk to? Sam. I bet Sam's free.
and usually I am. Like that's the beauty of doing the podcast full time. Like I jump on Dan's Monday noon stream.
Yeah, because you just can't
when he does it. Because I'm just home doing nothing. I'm like, yeah, I'll jump on, dude. I'll like take a couple hours away from editing to play some magic with you. Yeah, that part is fun. I do feel bad that I'm like the worst stream guest for late night streams because people invite me and I'm like, I just don't have the time. I'm a great guest when I'm there.
I'm in bed at 9 p.m. Come on.
Dude, yeah. I tried to be, but I at least want to be playing some video games before I go to bed and hanging out with my lovely wife. So, you know, I already play Magic on Tuesdays. I record on Thursdays. There's only so many nights of the week to Magic.
Look, the creator scene is tough for us wife guys. Let me tell you.
Dude, it literally is, man. All these single people out there, they're like, I'll stream every single night. I'm like, I can't be doing that.
Yeah, exactly. 7 p.m. That's when I hang out with my hot employed wife.
Literally. that's like when I need to have dinner on the table for my lovely wife when she comes home from work.
It's like, well, special shout out to Jen for making me a Cobb salad so I can be recording at 6:40 p.m. Eastern on a weekday. Otherwise, this would never be happening.
Yeah, it's a struggle. I think the work-life balance when you're doing something like this is a huge struggle. It's crazy.
But yeah, especially once you're like full time.
Oh yeah. Cause it's like on one hand I don't work, and on the other hand, every day is a work day.
Yeah, certainly. It's like that was one of the toughest parts about that was one of the things that contributed to me eventually like leaving Playing With Power, because like it wasn't my full time job, but when I was the social media guy, it was kind of just like always online. Like that was kind of my job.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Or like,
that's the hard,
we had a, we had a really big online community. And so there's always like, you know, I could always hop in the Discord and chat with the guys and the girls. I love doing it, but it's, you know, it's part of its work too, which is just weird. But
yeah, I feel like my phone is constantly buzzing because I do all the social media for Alex Altman too.
Yeah, exactly. And if you, if it, it past a point, there's just literally always something you could be doing.
Yes.
Yeah. You could
there
be,
literally is.
You could be putting more effort into the parody song. You could be lining up your second guest. You could be, you know, you could be
drawing more playmats,
which
people are always people are like, give us more playmats.
Exactly. Like,
I want to.
Exactly.
Please, I want
it's just
to.
Like there's literally always something you could be doing. And it's just you could be stream guesting on a new stream and plugging your podcast for a new audience to maybe hear about it. There's just literally always something. So
there's so much that you can do. So you really have to like take your moments, find your time, and like turn off your phone every once in a while.
have you like figured out, do you have like a system? Because I know some people have a system.
Oh, but no, my system is that I have a horrible ADHD and anxiety.
Okay.
And I'm a chronic procrastinator.
Okay.
So usually I will like read manga for 4 hours then be like, oh my God, I have so much I need to do.
are you so
that's usually my
system. Sam, are you a One Piece reader?
Oh, you know it, dude.
All right, everyone, turn off the podcast. We're spoiling Egghead right now. Okay,
I would love to. Are you kidding me? I've already talked to Andrew Rothwell and Tori from Scribe Babies and like so many other people about making like a One Piece podcast. That would be like my dream. I already have like a name. I've like, you know, I've got a lot of stuff figured out
that
for
makes
that.
Sense.
So maybe someday.
Maybe someday. You know, just like a fifth project for your plate.
Yeah, exactly. In between all the other stuff. But yeah, I love One Piece. I love manga just in general. When I was younger, I was a big anime kid and I really enjoyed it. But as you get older, like I just don't have the time to binge, you know, 6 to 10 hours of television to crush even a small season of a show. But anime but manga, like, please, I can, you know, use the bathroom and read a couple chapters or like read 10 before I go to bed and read another 10 when I wake up. Like it's so easy to just crush manga.
Get through
it's
the it.
Best.
Yeah.
I love it.
It is a very approachable art form. As long once you get used to swiping left, then you're set. Sorry, swiping right.
I scroll down. I'm a scroll downer.
Scroll downer. Sheesh.
Yep.
This guy does not use the Shonen Jump app.
I don't. I use some illegal.
Yeah, Sam does not support creators. Write that down.
No, I kidding. Dare not speak its name.
I'm kidding.
I will not out my
Harold's horn suddenly gets nuked from the internet. Oh, what happened? Well, the entire weight of the manga publishing industry came down on this little Magic the Gathering Oda podcast.
I sent you a seat for the shit.
Just a little fish head drawing at the end. My apologies.
This is the most charming legal document.
Yeah, I'd frame that on my wall. Yeah. Got a cease and desist from Oda? Please.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'll blame it on a coworker. A coworker got me hooked on manga a long time ago. He continued to talk to me about manga over and over again.
You're like, I don't care, bro.
Yeah, I was like, I just don't read manga, man. Yep. I don't fucking read it. And one day he was like, read this manga. Read the first 3 chapters.
And then let me know how you feel.
Yeah, it was like a
classic
Friday. Yeah. And he was like, read this, and if you don't like it, then I'll stop bugging you about it. And it was, what was it? Paradise something. It just became an anime. I'm ashamed that I'm forgetting the name. People are screaming into their radios at home. But I came back in on Monday, and he was like, so what did you think? I was like, it was really good. And he was like, yeah, so you think you're going to keep reading it? And I was like, oh, no, I read the whole thing.
No, actually, there's no more for me to read.
Yeah, I read all 80 chapters, actually. So
yeah, I'm done.
And then after that, I mean, One Piece was, whew, man, like last summer, there were just days where all I would do is read One Piece, and I would read like 60 or 70 chapters in a day. I was chugging through it.
Yep.
But yeah, it's fun. Hey, to all the tutors and duders out there, check out manga.
Read One Piece.
Yeah, and read One Piece.
Maybe read something else first.
Read something small first, and then
read whatever into, like, Sam's first manga was, which will obviously be in the YouTube comments.
Yeah, exactly. We'll Dan will do a voiceover right now saying what it is. Pause.
Unfortunately, Dan was not available, so it's me, Cal, to say it was Hell's Paradise.
All right.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan. For that, Dan. That's so nice of you. Dan's guest appearance for the episode. Not a co-host for this episode. Come on, Dan. Well, Sam, thank you for talking to me for the platonically ideal approximately 40 minutes.
No problem, Cal. I could talk to you for literally hours. So I appreciate that you are cutting it off because I cannot
stop. We can just keep going. You can just keep talking and talking and talking. So you're the ideal podcast guest.
Literally. Sometimes I take over the show a little bit and that's feel fine. Bad about it afterwards.
That's fine. it's my job to run the part of the show that I technically host, and it's my job to also make sure that I line up people who will talk so much on the second half of the show.
Hell,
because I talk so much on the first half of the show. We gotta find an equilibrium, you know?
Yeah, that's great. On the Howling Salt Mine, I just talk the whole time. I don't even think about the equilibrium.
That's, you know, I think that's a good spot to be. Oh, quick yes. question. Are you into wrestling at all? Are you familiar with heel, face, etc. dynamics?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I watched a lot of wrestling when I was a young boy, but kind of fell off as I got older. And then every once in a while, I see little bits of it.
Okay. No thought. Wrestling archetypes for yourself, Mike and Tony.
Ooh, Tony's the heel.
Yeah, okay. I knew you were going to say that one. That's what inspired the question.
I definitely flop between like the face and the heel.
Little anti-hero action?
Yeah, a little bit, depending on the vibe of the episode. Like, if it's an episode with just me and Mike, I have to lean into Tony's role. If it's an episode with me and Tony, I have to lean into Mike's role. Mike is really like the, I don't know what the wrestling term would be, but he's like the straight man. He's like the person who, if we tell a dirty joke, he's like, ooh, come on, guys, yep. You know? Also, his whole family listens to the podcast. So sometimes it's a pretty genuine groan that we get from him.
I would maybe call that the steady hand. You know, there's sometimes wrestlers who like don't have, not to say that he doesn't have much character, but there's sometimes characters that kind of eschew the heel and face thing, and they're just available to have a great, good, solid match with whoever needs one. Don't need to worry about a story. 100%. They're just there to wrestle.
Yep, he's just there to podcast.
I'm just here to groan at the jokes.
Yeah, and he like flips and flops. It's funny having a podcast that goes on for so long because those roles have like carved out almost into like little caricatures of ourselves. Like Tony definitely turns up, his style of humor and stuff like that, and some like the wild outlandish things he says. He definitely turns it up for the show. And, you know, to some extent, I turn up some of it too. And I think Mike turns up the groaning a lot too. We're a lot more even keeled in real life, but it's just funny how, like, you know, you find certain things that work on the show and people respond to them well. And you're like, well, you know, this is just going to happen more often. Probably. Mm-hmm. It's Flanderization, which is one of my favorite words.
Yes.
The prospectors know that I love that term a lot. And I'm starting to see it with us, which is very funny. Mm-hmm.
So for those people at home, definitely not me, who totally knows what Flanderization does. I do actually know what Flanderization is. Could you define Flanderization for the crowd at home? For those people who haven't watched Simpsons?
I would love to. So Flanderization is kind of the phenomena, usually with like sitcoms. It's most common in sitcoms, but it's the concept where a character becomes a caricature of themselves over the course of the run
like
of
whatever
of
they media. Were in like the first three seasons or whatever.
Exactly.
And then they just like become more of
you
that.
Take like the silliest attributes from them from the early seasons, and then that's the only thing they do in the later seasons. And Ned Flanders is where the term comes from. He's Homer Simpson's very like upstanding, high diddly ho neighbor, super polite, very Christian, kind of like this Christian stereotype almost at this point. But in early seasons of The Simpsons, Ned Flanders was just like a kind neighbor, and he would be concerned about Homer, and he would say hello, and he was very polite, and sometimes he would go to church, and that
yeah,
would
he'd be like,
up.
You should go to church, Homer, exactly. See you on Sunday, yeah.
And now in seasons, he's like, you know, he's like thumping a Bible and like crossing himself all the time and like proselytizing to random people in the street. And he's just become such an absurd character. And it kind of happens in every show. Like you think of even like Seinfeld or something, like George Costanza becomes this crazy, like insane person by the end of the show. And in season one, he's just kind of a jerk.
He's just kind of a silly guy who's a jerk. Yeah.
Yeah. And like How I Met Your Mother, Barney is like kind of this, like, you know, he's sort of like the ladies man of the group and, you know, maybe a little bit problematic in the early seasons. Towards the end, he's just like a full blown, like horny robot, womanizer's stereotype. So it's sort of this thing that, like, over the course of a show, by the end, the characters are just, you know, remnants of what they used to be. And I love that. I think it's a really funny thing when
it's a fascinating phenomenon.
Because I think it happens with almost every media outlet.
It's hard
because you see what works and you're like, I'll just
I'll just do that again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. For sure.
Yep.
Well, Flanders, thanks for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it a lot.
Anytime, Cal. This was super, super fun. Thanks for having me on. And we'll have to have you on the Howling Saltmine sometime. Have you weighing in on some salty stories?
We'd love to do that. I love to judge people. Of course, I already said there was a final question, but I am going to ask you one more.
Please.
I think you basically did already answer this question, but Sam, you're about 2 years in to this Howling Salt Mine journey. Started it, not on a whim, but started it to have fun. Now it's your full-time gig. What has been your favorite part of the experience?
I think my favorite part of the experience has been meeting people in the community, both creators and listeners and just random people at conventions. It's really the gathering, as like schmaltzy and
it's cliche because it's like what works.
It's true.
It's the objective truth. That's what it's about.
So true. Yep. Like every time I go to a convention, I come away just with like such a full heart and a love for the community that's out there. And I think sometimes people are on Twitter a little bit too much or Instagram or what have you. And you're just hearing all this negativity and drama. And then you meet people in real life and they're just awesome. Honestly, even on our show, we're reading all these horror stories about games going wrong. And then I meet people in real life and I'm like, oh, these games are amazing. And no one is salty. You know, it's kind of this thing where like bad news travels faster than good news.
Yep, certainly.
And I think that that is very real in the Magic community. So I just love meeting people, love playing games with people, and love to meet other creators and talk about what they're doing and you know, kind of talk shop and stuff like that. I think that's very, very fun.
Sam of the Howling Salt Mine podcast, thank you so much for coming on the Herald's Horn.
Cal, this was lovely. I will come into the bell of the horn anytime you want me to, which is where we've been recording this podcast.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Herald's Horn. If you liked what you heard, consider giving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you really enjoyed listening, you can support us directly on Patreon. I'll even send you a sticker in the mail. Every little bit helps us make the best podcast we can for you. Check out the link in the podcast description. Herald's Horn is hosted, edited, and produced by me, Cal Jones. The co-hosts are Emma Partlow, Lexi, better known as Black Girl Mage, and Dan, better known as Moderately Anonymous MTG. All of our info also lives in the podcast description. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Herald's Horn and any place else you can find us too. If you want to reach out to me about the podcast, hit up editorial@heraldshorn.com. I'd love to see your email. Thanks again for listening to the Herald's Horn. We're having so much fun creating it. See you in 2 weeks. Sam of the Howling Saltmine. Oh, brother!
Professional podcaster. See, if that happened on my show, I'd just cut that right out and stick it at the end as a blooper.
You just read my mind.